Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince, and welcome to this week's Rear Vision Podcast Extra. It's a program from 2006, and it demonstrates why history matters. Because while history doesn't repeat itself, events from decades ago can resonate today, and nowhere more so than in the Middle East. 20 years ago, in 2006, a war broke out between Lebanon and Israel. It's known as the Second Lebanon War. A Shiite Islamist political party and militant group, Hezbollah, which was based in Lebanon, crossed into Israel. They killed 8 Israeli soldiers and captured 2 others. Israel responded with an airstrike, a naval blockade, and a ground invasion of southern Lebanon. Sound familiar? This program profiles the rise of Hezbollah and explores the very different ways it was viewed in the West and in the Arab world. And while a lot has changed over the past 20 years, both politically and militarily, Hezbollah is still a key political and military force in Lebanon, a key ally of Iran, and is once again at war with Israel. So let's now head back in time to 2006 and the story of the group called Hezbollah.
Israel is encircling Lebanon as fighting continues after Hezbollah guerrillas abducted 2 of its soldiers earlier this week.
The Lebanese Prime Minister, Fuad Siniora, has accused his Israeli counterpart, Ehud Olmert, of opening the gates of hell.
Israel wants its captured soldiers returned, an end to the rocket attacks and the withdrawal and disarmament of the Lebanon-based group Hezbollah.
Hezbollah, together with Hamas, Syria and Iran, comprise the world's new and ominous axis of terror.
For 3 weeks, Lebanon, and to a lesser extent, northern Israel, have been ripped apart by the conflict between Hezbollah and the Israeli military. Israel and America lay the blame squarely at the feet of Hezbollah. Hezbollah, they argue, is one of the world's leading terrorist organizations. In the Arab world, it's a different story. It's Israel who is to blame. In this version of the story, Hezbollah is a hero, the only resistance movement in the Middle East prepared to stand up to Israeli aggression. So where does the truth lie, and just who and what is Hezbollah? Hezbollah first emerged in the 1980s from the Shiite communities of the South. 2 events are seen as critical to its creation: the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982.
If the rest of the world doubted the correctness of Israel's military lunge into Lebanon, there was, as in past wars, no doubt at all in the minds of the Israeli leadership.
We want to smash once and for all the infrastructure of the terrorist PLO. As you know, the PLO has been harassing Israeli civilians from Lebanese soil all these years.
They are a creation in some ways of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which, as you recall, was meant to drive out the PLO from South Lebanon.
Jeffrey Goldberg was the Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker and the author of a series of articles on Hezbollah entitled In the Party of God.
The PLO, of course, was, I mean, it sounds like we're not progressing very fast in the Middle East. The PLO was firing rockets into Israel, and Israel and its defense minister, Ariel Sharon, wanted to remove that presence from South Lebanon. As most people know, Sharon went too far, took it all the way to Beirut with a land invasion. And one of the things, one of the byproducts of this was to create a Shiite resistance to Israel. Now, one of the many interesting twists of this is, of course, that when the Israelis entered South Lebanon in 1982, they were met with flowers and candy, as the expression goes, by the Shiites. The Shiites were terribly oppressed by the PLO, by Yasser Arafat's organization in South Lebanon. So they were glad to have the Israelis, but the Israelis overstayed their welcome. And so out of that, Hezbollah was born, but out of something even more important, Hezbollah was born. Hezbollah was born by the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Shiism, the Shiite branch of Islam, had been until 1979, or late 70s, mostly a quietist movement. It wasn't political. It was spiritual more than anything else. And the Shiites separated out government from religion. What the Iranian Revolution under Ayatollah Khomeini did was to spark a political rise among the Shiites in a lot of different places, but especially in Lebanon. I guess you would say that the two fathers of Hezbollah are Ayatollah Khomeini and Ariel Sharon.
While the Shiite community was initially willing to see the South cleared of the PLO, according to Halal Jalbeer, Beirut correspondent for the Sunday Times and author of Hezbollah, Born with a Vengeance, it wasn't long before they realised that Israel intended to stay.
The indignation against Israel's role in the events leading up to last week's massacres of Palestinian civilians in West Beirut spread quickly through the normally pro-Israel Congress. There was little question that the grisly events in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps had cast a shadow over the traditionally strong ties between Israel and the United States.
And the massacres indicated that it wasn't going to be a friendly occupation.
When they realized that the Israelis were there to stay and the Israelis made sure that they were staying and declared that they were staying, that's when the Shiites then rebelled, if you want. Then they saw that the Israelis also went into Palestinian camps and did the massacres of Sabra and Shatila. So it showed, and Sabra and Shatila were at that point in time empty, if you want, or had been vacated of the fighters, because most of these fighters had been put on ships and taken out of Lebanon. So, in effect, what all this did was to enforce, if you want, in the Shiite mentality that the Israelis were not here on a friendly basis, not that an invasion or an occupation was a friendly basis, but they also meant harm to the locals and the people. When they bombed indiscriminately. They bombed homes, they bombed farms, they bombed orchards, you know. People's livelihood basically were destroyed by the bombing and the air raids carried out by the Israelis. So as this went on over the years, the Shiites became more radicalized and then decided that there was no way they were going to accept this, and the only way to counter it was to resist.
In 1982, a multinational force comprising US Marines and French and Italian soldiers arrived in Beirut. Their role was to separate the Israeli military and the PLO and to protect unarmed Lebanese civilians. But their presence made them a target for terrorist attacks.
The first that I heard was a loud explosion. The door next to my rack fell down across the rabbi that was sleeping next to me, and glass imploded all over the area.
The bombing of the American military post in Beirut has wiped out almost a tenth of the American Marines serving in Lebanon as part of the International Peacekeeping Force, along with 25 Frenchmen.
Trying to establish who might be responsible is an almost impossible task. No one has yet claimed responsibility. It's very possible no one ever will. Suspicion, though, falls in a number of directions. First, it must be remembered that both the French and the Americans have a lot of enemies in this area, within the radical states and also, of course, the Iranians. The other is the Syrians and their allies, the Palestinians and other radical Arab states.
To this day, America believes that Hezbollah was responsible for the Marine bombings in 1983. But journalist Halal Jalbeer, like many in the Middle East, questions this.
No one can actually provide hard evidence and say that they are definitely, as an organization, as Hezbollah, they are the ones behind these particular acts that you just mentioned, be it the bombing of the Marines or the kidnapping of the Western hostages. In those days, Hezbollah was just really at the beginning. I mean, it was still in its embryonic state, if you want. And they were related to other groups. They were related to the Iranians who had presence here. It was not so much Hezbollah per se, as you know it now, that was behind these. They did not sort of plan, plot, and execute these kind of things. If you look at Hezbollah now, you cannot actually say they were behind those particular acts. If they had known, if they knew some of the people, if some of those people worked both ways, i.e. sometimes they did things with Hezbollah, but they did things for Iran or for the revolution or what have you, obviously Hezbollah turned a blind eye, because at that point in time it was not going to be the protector of the United States, which was backing Israel against Lebanon, nor the police for the Israelis, which was occupying Lebanon.
Well, that's the Hezbollah line. That's what they argue. I don't think it holds a lot of water, especially when you look at the involvement of people like Imad Mughniya, who was a very important and secretive player in Hezbollah. He is the leader of its, I guess you would call it, external apparatus. Very well known in counterterrorism circles as a very, very good terrorist, very good at his job. And he was intimately involved in these early activities. And of course, Hezbollah didn't operate under the Hezbollah name. Hezbollah changed its name from Islamic Jihad Organization, IJO, people refer to it as, after those activities, the Marine barracks bombing in particular, in order to put distance between itself and the notoriety of those terror attacks. They certainly don't want American people to believe that this is the organization behind the Marine barracks bombing in which 241 American Marines died.
Amal Saad Ghoraib, academic and author of Hezbollah, Politics and Religion, argues that America was not a neutral bystander.
The Marines bombing is very hard to classify as an act of terrorism, even by US standards, because the Marines were not neutral bystanders or peacekeepers in the war. They were bombing Muslim areas of Lebanon. They bombed the Shuf Mountains, for example. They took sides. They sided with Israel. And this is why they were bombed. This is why they were attacked, not because they were innocent peacekeepers, like UNIFIL is today, for example. And people always overlook that fact, that in Lebanon, this is not regarded as an act of terrorism.
I guess if you think that the murder of 241 sleeping Marines is a legitimate resistance activity, then that's your opinion. My opinion, it's terrorism, particularly when you consider that the Americans went into Lebanon, they went into Beirut in order to separate out the Israelis from the Arab population. There are many instances of the Americans actually pushing back the Israelis. This grouping in Lebanon was an external player, an external representative of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which, of course, was behind the taking of the American embassy in 1979 in Tehran. So they were anti-American from the start.
Hezbollah's relationship with Iran has always been under suspicion.
Hezbollah was not completely organic in the Lebanese political scene. Iranians went to Lebanon, found some promising young radical clerics among the Shiites, people who had been trained in Iran, and organized this group. So at the very least, they midwifed it. And then, of course, like any child, a parent-child relationship, they fed it. They paid for its education. They bought it its weapons. So the links are deep and abiding.
Financially, Iran played a very large role in assisting the organization. This is common knowledge. And we did have over 1,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guards stationed in the Bekaa, who also provided this incipient movement at the time with the necessary training, military training and so on. So Iran in the early stages of Hezbollah's genesis played a very important role. But later on, Hezbollah became much more autonomous from Iran.
When Hezbollah came about, the Shiite community in Lebanon was at the bottom of the ladder. And the Lebanese government had always for years neglected South Lebanon and the Bekaa and all the, you know, mainly wherever Shiites were, they were horrendously neglected by the government. So when Hezbollah came, it was financed by Iran, like lots of other militias in Lebanon were at the time, although Hezbollah was not a militia per se. What it did is actually used a lot of the finances. It created a social network. In effect, what it did, it provided hospitals in areas and villages where the Lebanese government did not have hospitals or had not provided hospitals. It extended electricity. It created water wells, clinics, schools, subsidized a lot of those, pharmacies, co-ops. Where the government failed, Hezbollah filled in, if you want.
That's one of the ways they derive their power. They're better at delivering social services and schooling than governmental organizations. This is also true with Hamas in Gaza and in the West Bank. One of the reasons I think Hamas won those recent Palestinian elections is because the Fatah, the PLO government, was corrupt and was not providing basic services like garbage collection or good schools to its population. And in Lebanon, you have the same sort of situation. The state is not the most effective state in the world in terms of providing governmental services. So Hezbollah steps in, fills that gap.
Now, people say because of that, they have followers. Maybe in the beginning, because of that, they attracted followers as well. But over the years, the government has gone to same sort of areas, and they've created some schools here and there. They've improved on roads and what have you. The fact is people now are following Hezbollah not because of the social network. They're following Hezbollah, or they encourage it, or they affiliate with it, because they actually believe that it's the group that represents them. It has done them good. And it's the one group at the moment in Lebanon that can defend them as a Shiite community against any Israeli aggression. So it's evolved. It's gone beyond just followers because, you know, we're paying you money or we're giving you a free seat at school or a free bed in hospital, therefore you become a member. None of them are members of Hezbollah. They just agree with Hezbollah's politics. They think they are the least corrupt in the country, and they have done well for their community.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via your MP3 player with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, I'm taking a look at the history of Hezbollah. With the end of the Lebanese Civil War in 1989, Hezbollah began to move into the mainstream political process. But unlike other militia groups in Lebanon, it didn't disarm. Juan Cole is professor of Middle East history at Michigan University.
The Taif Accord of 1989 stipulated that the paramilitaries be dissolved that were attached to the various Lebanese political parties. And in the area of Beirut and points north, over time through the 1990s, they actually did disarm in favor of a nascent reconstituted Lebanese army. The paramilitary of Hezbollah was not required to dissolve primarily because the Israelis had continued to occupy Lebanese soil in the south. There were actually Israeli troops on Lebanese soil. Lebanon was afraid of losing parts of the south to Israel, and Hezbollah was the instrument whereby the Israeli occupation was opposed. And the rest of the groups in Lebanon, whatever they may feel about Hezbollah as a political party or ideology, respect that it did make sacrifices and it did work to get back sovereignty for Lebanon and to expel the Israeli occupiers.
There's chaos in South Lebanon this morning as Israel continues its withdrawal from its security zone there. Two-thirds of the area that Israel held a week ago are now in the hands of the Hezbollah and Amal militia.
Israel finally withdrew from South Lebanon in May 2000.
The Israelis themselves admitted that they withdrew because of Hezbollah. There's no question about it. It wasn't because, you know, Israel decided it was enough, you know, simply. Why was it enough? They couldn't sustain the casualties. They were bogged down in Lebanon. It had been, you know, 18 years, and they hadn't been able to root out the organization. So they decided then that it was futile and withdrew. And in fact, a lot of Israeli commentators and officials even are now saying that they don't want to repeat that scenario.
Despite Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, Hezbollah has retained its presence on the border, claiming that Israel is still occupying a small area known as Shebra Farms.
The United Nations and Kofi Annan said this specifically, that the Shebra Farms area, to which you're referring to, it's about a 2-square-mile piece of land, belongs to Syria and therefore is subject to Syrian-Israeli negotiations. The United Nations, which never takes Israel's side on anything, took Israel's side on this question and said that no, they confirmed that Israel had left all of Lebanon. So by the standards of international law and by the United Nations, Israel is not an occupying power in Lebanon.
In the past 6 years, for example, since their withdrawal, they have, I think, 650 violations across Lebanon. So Hezbollah is being regarded as a deterring force in order to prevent any Israeli incursions over the years or any Israeli reason to think that they can just walk into Lebanon like they used to do in the past. That's why they left them and they said Hezbollah will not disarm, and Hezbollah said we will not disarm until we are guaranteed and the Middle East issue with Israel is solved. We are guaranteed that, you know, there won't be any such confrontations with Israel.
There is a new phase of confrontation, of struggle, which is imposed on us by the enemy as the only option. In the new stage, our attacks shall not be confined to Haifa.
As he spoke, his fighters in southern Lebanon unleashed another barrage of Katyusha rockets onto the Israeli seaside town.
There is, of course, Sheikh Nasrallah, who is the leader of the group. I'm not sure he's the most powerful person. There's some speculation that Mughniyeh, this terrorist figure going back 25 years, is the most powerful person. Of course, there's a ruling council of about 8 to 10 men who are clerics mostly, and the power resides with them. There's a spiritual leader, Sheikh Fadlallah, of course, who maintains a semi-independent posture from Hezbollah. But this is not a democratic organization.
Hezbollah is not some underground terrorist organization or some outlawed militia. Hezbollah is a legitimate political player. It has two ministers in the cabinet. It has 14 members of parliament. And the Lebanese government's policy statement legitimizes Hezbollah's resistance. And the Taif Accord, in fact, also legitimizes Hezbollah's resistance. So being so firmly rooted in the Lebanese political system not only legitimizes a political party but as a resistance as well really complicates this issue for Israel and the U.S.
Unlike many of the other militias, and the government. Hezbollah did not come into being in order, for example, to make money. You look at the Hezbollah leadership, for example, you find them all living in the most simple, basic homes. They can live whatever they want, but they live with the people, amongst the people, you know, that they represent, in the poorest of area. Dahiya, which is the southern suburbs which has been bombarded, is known in Lebanon to be the belt of misery because of all the refugees and the poor that live there. That's where Hezbollah lives. It's amongst them.
The positive spin is that they're located with the people. The negative spin is that they're hiding behind women and children. I was struck by this, that Hezbollah's key offices, including some of its military offices, were located on the first and second and third stories of residential apartment buildings. So literally, they had placed five or six stories of families between their offices and the Israeli Air Force. This is obviously not completely uncommon among Middle Eastern terrorist organizations. Even more morally dubious was the decision Hezbollah made to use schools and mosques as repositories, as armories, essentially. I mean, one of the things that I heard frequently in Lebanon, and one of the things that I think is coming out a little bit now, is that rockets, 13,000 rockets they have to hide them somewhere, and some of the places that they hide them are in people's houses, and under mosques, and near schools. Put it this way, it's a very morally utilitarian view, or expedient view, which is that we're going to hide these rockets and hide our forces among the people to make it very difficult morally and politically for Israel to attack our rocket forces. And, of course, that's what you see playing out right now.
It's not untrue that they live in the southern suburbs and therefore they live amongst the people. What is untrue is what Israel is saying, that they are hiding behind the people. I mean, we go back to that point, you see. They're making them out to be like a bunch of aliens that came from abroad and are living amongst the people to hide behind them, to use them if you want. Like the Israelis have been saying lately, they're using the residents or the people in the south as hostages. They're putting them in the front. We go back to the point I mentioned earlier. Hezbollah are Lebanese. They're Shiites. They're from the south. They are from the same people. They have never hidden where they live. They have never hidden their offices. These offices, these buildings, have been in the public domain. Everybody who's anybody knows where they are for the past 24 years. They have not moved.
To give you an example, even last week when Israel started bombing southern Lebanon and the southern suburbs of Beirut, Hezbollah very successfully evacuated the suburbs, evacuated all civilians from this area. And had that not been the case, we would have witnessed thousands more deaths than we've seen today. It wasn't because of Israeli mercy, but rather because Hezbollah, in a very organized fashion, evacuated the area. They went from house to house, telling families to flee.
What we have to get out of in our thinking is that this is some sort of an independent organization. Hezbollah does Iran's bidding. And, of course, Hezbollah helps Syria by pressuring Israel militarily. Remember, Syria has an outstanding account with Israel. It wants the Golan Heights back that Israel took in the Six-Day War in 1967. And it's very useful for Syria to have this terror outfit on the Lebanese border.
Both Iran and Syria are major allies of Hezbollah. There's no doubt about that. They have supported it over the years. They have backed it. They have financed it. They have trained it. Inasmuch as the United States, for example, at this particular point, backs and supports Israel. I mean, half of the Israel arsenal is American. Only 2 days ago, the Americans are now pushing for 100 missiles that the Israelis are desperately in need of, laser missiles, to hit Lebanon, by the way. So the relationship is similar. Now, the argument that Hezbollah is actually carrying out or went and captured two soldiers on behalf of Iran and Syria, that is not true. I mean, there are general political outlines that are agreed between Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah, obviously. But it's not a case where this organization has to go and knock on the door of Syria or Iran every time it needs to make a breath or a step in Lebanon.
I think it's virtually impossible for Israel to destroy Hezbollah. I mean, unless it's willing to carry out a genocide of the entire Shiite community for many years to come, and in the process kill some Hezbollah leadership and fighters along with the rest of the Shiites, then yes. Otherwise, how on earth can Israel dismantle Hezbollah? For 18 years, back from 82 till 2000, it failed to do so. Why should we assume that it's able to do so now, when Hezbollah has had a six-year grace period in which to recuperate and strengthen itself and arm itself and train its members? And not only that, But Hezbollah has clearly shown it has a significant deterrent capability. Its attacks on Israeli cities has continued unabated, and therefore this calls into question Israeli claims that it's destroyed 50% of Hezbollah's military capability by its air power. I mean, if that was the case, then why did it resort to a much riskier land incursion than a land invasion?
If it had been anywhere but Lebanon, if Israel or some other country had inflicted that kind of damage on another country, do you think the West would have stood by and let it happen?
Absolutely not, but they always do in Lebanon, and because it's Israel. I mean, you know, people think we're biased when we say this because we're Lebanese, but that's the fact. That's what's been happening since 1978, since the first invasion, then in 1982, then in 1993, then in 1996, and now in 2006. And each and every time, the West has stood by and allowed Israel. I mean, even Condoleezza Rice's trip to Lebanon or to the Middle East was delayed in order to give Israel more opportunity to continue with its pre-prepared plan to destroy Lebanon. Had this been the reverse, had Lebanon invaded or attacked Israel in that manner, within the first 24 hours, you know, the entire international community would have been screaming up and down.
The 2006 conflict between Israel and Hezbollah lasted for 34 days. The current conflict, which began after Hamas's terrorist attack on Israel in 2023 and escalated in March this year, has lasted much longer. And this time, Hezbollah has suffered the loss of many of its senior leaders, including its longtime Secretary General, Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated by the Israeli military in September 2024. If you want to get a greater understanding of the current conflict, the next Rear Vision will explain the broader history of Lebanon and its relationship with Israel. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is a Rear Vision podcast extra.